Have you ever found yourself in a tough conversation about faith, unsure of what to say or how to say it? Maybe with a skeptic, a friend, or even a family member? We want to help. That's why we're giving you a free download of 5 Steps to Having Better Conversations. This powerful guide will equip you to navigate faith discussions with confidence, wisdom, and grace, so that you can share your beliefs in a way that truly connects. Get your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Don't miss out. Start having better, more meaningful conversations today.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're back from our little Christmas New Year break. I hope you enjoyed those old episodes on the feed over the last few weeks. But we're back with a brand new episode today, picking up on a number of themes really in the news. There's been a renewed focus on social media and some of the harm it can cause, particularly people talking a lot about the app TikTok, which is due to be banned in the United States in the coming days and is currently kind of fighting for its life in a Supreme Court, trying to get the court to strike down this ban, which is due to take effect next week, I believe. And that's actually around kind of national security concerns, isn't it? And about, you know, fear that China is harvesting Americans' data and could manipulate people through the app. But there's a more general sense over the coming months, isn't there, that social media is a kind of toxic, divisive, hate, or increasingly a kind of toxic, divisive and hateful place.
Yes, because in America, the big tech companies are American. They have this absolute commitment to free speech in a way which sometimes as Europeans we find quite surprising. And so it seems as though, particularly the influence of Elon Musk, has been to bang that drum very strongly to try to minimize the amount of censorship that is going on in social media platforms. But that the inevitable consequence of that, I think, is that there seems to be more of what we would recognize as hate speech of all kinds seems to be just circulating on these platforms.
Yeah, interesting announcement in the last couple of days about Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and a few other platforms run by Mark Zuckerberg, of course, announcing that they are kind of abandoning their collaborations with fact checkers. And so they're no longer going to be kind of paying for professional fact checking of popular posts. This is often kind of interpreted as people seen as trying to kind of appease Donald Trump, who's about to re-enter the White House. And Elon Musk, when he took over Twitter, now X, a few years ago, one of the big things he did was get rid of all the moderation and try and turn it into a more kind of free speech forward space, which has certainly ramped up the kind of controversial content and divisive hate speech. But what we want to talk about today was not just the kind of poisoning of the well of social media for adults, but actually how social media itself, even when it's not full of, you know, Nazis and horrible stuff, is still, the evidence is increasingly becoming clear that that social media and digital technologies and smartphones are profoundly bad for younger people, for children and adolescents.
That's right. And a key figure in all this has been Jonathan Haidt, who's a American professor of psychology, who has been one of the people who's been highlighting the evidence on the rising rates of mental illness, of self-harm, attempts at suicide, and so on in adolescents. And he relates them very strongly to two factors, one of which is very well known, and that is the increase in smartphone usage and social media involvement of children and adolescents. But the other one which he emphasizes, and I think is equally important, but hasn't received anything like the same kind of profile, and that is, he says it's overprotection in the physical world, that parents have been overprotective and not enabled their children to take risks in the physical world, and that that has also contributed to the rise of mental health difficulties.
Mm. And Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation, which was published last year, made a bit of a stir, didn't it, when it came out, because he kind of makes quite aggressively the case that this spike in various measures of kind of mental ill health, whether that's rates of self-harm and suicide or self-reported depression or, you know, diagnoses of anxiety, have rocketed over the last 10 years or so, but in particular accelerating in the period from 2010 to 2015. And that is the exact period, he argues, when smartphones and social media became kind of ubiquitous among young people in the industrialized West. And he's obviously focusing on the United States, but it's true of much of the Western world as well. Is this just correlation not implying causation? Is it just a coincidence that these mental health conditions start to become much more of a problem around the time that everyone starts living on their phones?
Well, it has been highly contested, and I've read the book, and I strongly recommend it, you know, because I think it's very well argued. I think he doesn't, it's not just a rant. He accumulates a very large amount of evidence, which I find very persuasive. But it has been, there's been a very strong pushback. I think a lot of pushback came from professional psychiatrists and psychologists. And I suspect, to be honest, there's a certain amount of sour grapes, which I recognize, which is when one member of a profession suddenly is being lauded in the public square. There's an awful lot of sour grapes from, well, I didn't think it was that, and I think his evidence is pretty poor, and so on and so on, from his colleagues. But I think there's also been a whole group saying, oh, this is just another moral panic quotes, you know, one of those from time to time, society gets incredibly upset about some new development, and then it all settles down and everyone accepts it. And so it is argued that this is just a moral panic about smartphones.
Mm. And you know, there's been lots of moral panics in the past about things that we today think are pretty unobjectionable. I mean, when the radio kind of took off, you could find newspaper articles from shortly afterwards, people kind of bemoaning how much time people were spending glued to their wireless sets. Likewise, TV, of course, you know, you get square eyes if you sit too close to it. Even things like crossword puzzles had a kind of craze when they were invented, and you know. There was even when the post was invented in the 19th century and you could send cheaply write letters to people, there was a kind of bemoaning how much time people were spending writing letters to each other. So there's often been a new technology kind of goes on this incredible upward tick of adoption, and the old generations are just kind of slightly baffled and bemused by this and slightly freak out about it.
Yeah, in fact, you can go all the way back to Plato and Socrates, who argued that the invention of writing was going to be absolutely catastrophic for human thinking, you know, and that, but it was ironic that the only reason we know that they said that was because it was all written down.
Written down, yes.
So, yeah.
Humankind seems to have survived the invention of literacy, okay.
But there are, of course, counterexamples, and a very good one is cigarette smoking, because, you know, in the Second World War and in the early 50s and 60s, cigarette smoking was actually promoted as being good for you and health promoting and recommended and widely adopted and so on. And, of course, then what accumulates is evidence that this is genuinely harmful, that it causes cancer and lots of other things, lung disease of various kinds. Mm. And yet it's taken decades to slowly reduce the incidence of cigarette smoking, which we know causes an immense amount of damage. So the question is smartphone use among children more like crossword puzzles, or is it more like tobacco?
Mm. And the tobacco comparison is interesting, because I think a lot of people presume in this conversation that we're talking about quite kind of nebulous ideas, you know, oh, it might be bad for them and change the way they think about themselves or how they play. But actually, Haidt you know, he's quite rigorous and in the book is full of, you know, studies and data that say, no, I'm talking about medically diagnosable mental health conditions and things like, you know, substance abuse, self-harm, visits to emergency rooms, suicide attempts. And these have measurably, demonstrably gone up, and not by 5%, 10%, but sometimes by the hundreds of percent.
They have. And the graphs he presents in the book and others have done similar work are really very startling. I mean, I think no one can deny that something has changed since 2010. You know, in the last 15 years, there has been a dramatic increase in mental health issues amongst young people, both women and men, but particularly among the females. And then the question is, well, are there other things which could have caused it? And of course, that's what's been argued. There have been many other potential factors. For instance, the incidence of unemployment and economic hardship following the big market collapse in the 2000s. There's all the doom-laden international scene. There's climate anxiety. There's a sense of hopelessness about the economy. And the argument goes, these are the things which are causing the mental distress. And it's really nothing to do with smartphones and social media.
And there's a kind of superficial appeal to that. I think everyone often feels like their generation is going through a uniquely challenging time. But I think certainly, you know, I'm a millennial and a Gen Z, but there was a lot of kind of woe is me prevalent when I was growing up, from kind of teenage years into early adulthood, you know, coming of age during the Great Recession and the credit crunch and era of austerity you know, war on terror and a period of international instability. But actually, it's hard to make the case that things are, you know, over the longer term, over the kind of multi-decade long view, things are really significantly worse now than they were, say, when you grew up, you know, during the period of the Cold War, when you had two nuclear superpowers facing each other and inflation running at 25%.
Yeah, we had the IRA bombings. Yeah. You know, you couldn't get onto a bus in central London without wondering whether it was going to be blown up. You know, there was 9/11. So I think to make the argument that since 2010, it has been uniquely terrifying and anxiety-inducing compared to what came before, that's really quite hard to make. And the argument goes that for some reason there's a remarkable fragility about an emotional and relational fragility.
Yes.
About the younger generation, particularly Gen Z, which wasn't true of earlier generations.
And this age split is very important and is made a lot of by Haidt in the book. I'm looking at a graph here. He has anxiety prevalence by age, where he's got broken the population down into kind of different age chunks and looked at people who report high levels of anxiety. And so if you're in the age group 50 or 50 plus, there has been no change in 2010. In fact, it's gone down slightly by 8%. If you're 35 to 49, anxiety is increased by 52%, which seems a lot. And if you're 26 to 34, that's my age group, anxiety is increased by 103%. So that's more than doubled. And if you're 18 to 25, so you're Gen Z, anxiety since 2010 has gone up by 139%. So you see, this is not just that we are all getting more anxious as the world gets more difficult, but this is something that is strongly correlated and skewed towards the younger you are, the more anxious you are.
That's right. And so Jonathan Haidt, just before we go on that, I think it's important to recognize this is a very widespread phenomenon across the world as well. In areas where there are good statistics, it seems that very similar phenomenon is being seen. So not just in the USA, but in the UK, in many European countries, Scandinavia, Australia, and so on.
Yeah. definitely. And I suspect if we had better data for the rest of the world, we'd see similar things, or at least maybe slightly delayed in parts of the developing world where smartphone usage and the spread of the internet's not been quite so high. I just think it's worth just rattling off a few more numbers, because I think, you know, I was aware of Jonathan Haidt's book, and I kind of knew the broad idea that mental illness was getting worse among young people. That I think that's kind of widely understood and recognized, but the scale of it is startling. So there's a very striking graph he has in the book, which is looking at college students. So these are, you know, 18 to 22, 24 year olds in the United States. Anxiety has increased by 134% since 2010. And so in raw terms, what that means, in 2010, about 10% of undergraduates were diagnosed with anxiety. Today, it's almost 25%. Depression has increased by 100%. That's gone up from about 10% in 2010, over 20% today. Something like ADHD has increased by 72%. Bipolar disorder has gone up by 57%. Anorexia has doubled 100% since 2010. Substance abuse and addictions up 33%. So these are not just, you know, 5% here, 10% here, you know, statistically significant rises, but, you know, long-term trends. This is a sudden explosion. At least the data that Haidt presents is a sudden explosion kicking off very, very much at the point when smartphones became ubiquitous.
So one of the essential scientific questions to ask is this evidence? We can see a statistical correlation, but correlation is not the same as causation. How do we determine causation? And there are several ways scientifically to do that. One is to look at an exclusion study. You know, could we find a population which doesn't have smartphones? And can we show that there hasn't been a rise? But another is to ask the question, what is the plausibility? What is the biological plausibility of the mechanism? So is it biologically plausible that exposure to smartphones and social media might have something to do with psychological development and particularly with resilience? And that's the question which I think is at the heart of this. And I think that Jonathan Haidt makes the case very strongly that actually there are lots of very well-recognized mechanisms for why exposure to social media in huge amounts and also restriction of play in the real world, why that might be associated with an increase in mental health problems.
Because it's not obvious to everyone why spending time chatting with your friends on WhatsApp and Snapchat and watching silly dance memes on TikTok would be so disastrously bad for you. These things aren't obviously harmful, which is why they initially become so popular. So what is Haidt's thesis about why it's so bad for us, and particularly for young people, to spend hours and hours a day scrolling on their phones?
So he starts, I think, very interestingly in making the case for the way that childhood has been carried out in the rest of human history, you know, over the last 50,000 years until the 21st century. How have children played? And this is where human development is, of course, very, very different from that of nearly all other mammals, because most mammals go through a period of development and then transition very rapidly into adulthood. The curious things about human beings is that we develop very rapidly over the first 3-4 years, but there is then this very prolonged phase which goes on for more than 10 years before we enter adult society and we take on adult roles. And a lot of that period between 4 and 18 is spent in play. What Haidt argues is that spending time out of the home with friends playing, that has been the pattern of human childhood since hunter-gatherer times. And apparently there's lots of evidence that this kind of physical play has an essential part in physical, mental and relational development. These relationships are synchronous, so you are chatting with your friends, you're exploring together, you're fighting, you're making up, you're playing games, singing games, all those kind of things that children do together. There are lots of psychological mechanisms why this phenomenon is an essential part of growing normal development. But in particular, it's a way of developing resilience, doing physically risky and unsupervised play. So one of the interesting things, Tim, isn't it? He shows a photograph of a playground from the USA in something like the 1950s or 1960s.
And it's these kind of, metal bars kind of frame, but it's enormous. It probably reaches up maybe 10 meters high in the sky. And you have children, who are maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, climbing up these ladders and then like dangling, like they're like monkey bars, but they're not, 6 feet up, they're 30 feet up. And it's not a kind of squishy, that kind of modern squishy asphalt they have in children's playgrounds. It's just a hard gravel floor, so it's like literally if a child makes a mistake and slips off these metal bars and falls 10 meters to the ground, there's a reasonable chance that they will do themselves like a serious injury, a kind of A&E trip injury. And this is just, they're completely unsupervised, there are no adults in shot that you can see. And then Height kind of compares this the next page to like a modern playground equipment, which is what we'll all be familiar with in playgrounds, those kind of like soft rounded plastic, you go up 3 or 4 steps and you're only a meter off the ground, and it's covered with, it's like a walkway on both sides, and there's a little bit where you can go down a small slide and there's a few bars to climb on, but if you drop you're only going to fall a meter to this squishy asphalt and your parent will probably be there holding your hand anyway. And he kind of makes the point that okay, maybe it was a little bit too dangerous in the 1950s, but we've massively overcompensated. And the kind of climbing frames that we unleash our children on today are, kids, frankly, are kind of too old for them by the time they're 5 or 6 years old. They're not challenging enough. They're not risky enough. They don't stretch muscles and brains enough in giving kids kind of challenges about how to maneuver over them carefully and well and take risks. And this is kind of sucking that vital risky play out of our childhoods.
Yeah, so it is fascinating, isn't it, how when you watch children playing, it's like almost instinctively they want to try something dangerous. They want to test themselves out, see whether I can balance, and go down backwards or do something else silly. And these days, there's almost always a parent intervening and saying, no, you don't do that. You're not allowed. And don't do it without me. And I must come. And just you wait there. And it's this kind of hyper-protective parenting. So he argues that actually doing this risky play is part of developing resilience, and it teaches you confidence, that you can manage yourself, the self-reliance, a positive outlook, exploring and discovering new things about yourself, new things about the world. And that's why children deliberately choose physically risky play, that it's a positive thing. But that for some reason, which is very hard really to unpick, modern parents have become incredibly overprotective and concerned about physical risks.
And it's even, you can even see it in my own lifetime. I think of, certainly some of the things that you let me do as a child, in North London, riding my bike around in a primary school age, up and down the street, well out of eyeshot of any parent in the house, on my own. And I think now, would I, if I had children that age, would I let them do that? I'm not sure. So even in the 30 years that I've been alive, it's ratcheted up even further. And even, what I was allowed to do in the 90s was nothing compared to what people were letting their kids do in a generation earlier. So it's kind of undeniable that we have become more cautious, or maybe we feel our children's vulnerability greater. And I think elements of that are about kind of society-wide panics about stranger danger and abduction and paedophiles. But that doesn't explain, as you say, the kind of physical risk of, you know, physically risky play in playgrounds and things like that. So this is something about how parents have become much, much more wary about exposing their children to all kinds of harm.
And this phenomenon of helicopter parenting, that whatever you do, I have to be up there at 1,000 feet, constantly monitoring, checking, supervising, intervening, available. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're going to come back to smartphones in schools, but apparently a lot of the resistance of that is from parents. Parents who say, I have to be in 24/7 contact with my child. My child might need me. I must be able to contact them at any moment.
And more than that, I must be able to track their location. Because what smartphones enable you to do is to see on a little map, a real time, a little blue dot pinging GPS of where your child is all the time. And most of the time, that's going to be in the classroom, in the school where you left them. But there's something about, you know, and even more so, I know of parents who have bought, you know, Apple AirTags and those kind of things and put it on a bracelet and put it on their child so that they can literally track their child, even when they don't have a phone. They leave the, you know, they can track them wherever they go. So there's something about, there's something odd, as you say, driven about this desire. And this is utterly speculative on my end, but I do wonder if it correlates with declining birth rates. Because if you have fewer children, then you are more and more.
They're all disposable. Yeah, when you got three, you know, Tim, you were basically pretty disposable.
Right, always, you lose one, okay, yeah, two more to
absolutely
go.
Absolutely right.
I think obviously no one thinks about it that blatantly. And I'm not suggesting that when people had five kids, they didn't love them in the same way. But I do think there's something about people have fewer kids, but they spend more money on them. They invest more emotionally in them. And therefore, it's not a surprise that they feel much more protective of them.
No, I think there's definitely something in that. And it we have become this kind of child-centered. It's almost nauseating, you know. I mean, I speak as a paediatrician. You know, I spent
you're a kid person, Dad.
But, you know, you can overdo this. When the little darlings become the absolute centre of all attention, everything revolves around the little darlings. There's something quite unhealthy about it.
Can be.
You know, the little darlings need to discover that they're not the centre of the universe. Because, again, it's interesting, isn't it? When the little darling eventually does leave home, are they equipped for the realities of life outside this protective blanket? So I think there is some. I think Haidt is definitely onto something here, which is actually, you know, if you think about what initiatives could you take, you know, we want all playgrounds to have removal of their safety equipment, you know, we want to increase the size of the bars, we want to, you know,
you joke, but actually I think there is already a small backlash against that. You know, I think in the last 10 years there's probably been a very small movement away from the kind of hyper padded cell version of childhoods. You know, I see it in our daughter's nursery where you know, they regularly do things like have a fire pit, you know, an open bonfire. And when our daughter was as young as 2 years old, they would be encouraging her to be, you know, approaching this open flames and cooking vegetables and learning how fire works. And obviously it's supervised by an adult, and she has, you know, when she's handling stuff, she's got this kind of like, you know, glove on, shoulder, like elbow length glove on. But we wouldn't let her play with an open fire at home when she was 2 years old. And yet they have this kind of, you know, Scandi forest school, get them outside, get them into nature. Let's get rid of the squidgy soft plastic and start using, you know, let them give them like a bunch of bricks and sticks and boxes and say, build your own thing. I'm not going to, you know, they've literally taken away the kind of professionally designed safe climbing frame and given them the nursery garden is now a kind of open play space. And they've just got like odds and ends and they say, you know, kids, take this and build your own stuff. So there is a slight move away from, you know, introducing a modicum of risk.
So this is trendy Oxford, isn't it? Yeah, this is what you expect when you're the children of academics. You know, they've got up there with the need about healthy play. Well, good on them. And maybe you're right. Maybe there is a change, but I suspect that the psychological origin of this is a lot of it is in the parents, and the parents will be exceedingly reluctant to forego the kind of control over physical risk. And yet the irony is, and this is the point that Haidt makes repeatedly, is that whilst parents have been ridiculously overprotective in the physical realm. When it comes to the smartphone, oh, off you go in your room. That's absolutely fine, darling. Just as long as I know where you are. There's completely lack of any kind of protection in the online world.
And we've been blind to the emotional and social mental dangers caused by scrolling, because we cannot, because our matrix of risk is focused on, you know, sharp corners, big drops and stranger danger, and we're not thinking about, well, what does it do to my child's brain to spend 4 hours every day looking at videos and TikTok, or to never have a conversation with a friend that's not mediated through an instant messaging platform? Because those things are much harder to understand. They're invisible to us. And they're dangers that, you know, most parents didn't have to deal with themselves. You know, if you're the parent of a teenager today, you didn't have a smartphone when you were a teenager. It didn't exist. TikTok wasn't a thing. And so you are very much a pioneer, and we're learning as we go. So I think we should have a bit of grace for parents maybe who were a bit oblivious to the harms.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. But I think... So what are the features of the smartphone childhood? And they're the opposite of what the play in the real world are. So instead of being embodied, it's all disembodied.
Hmm.
Instead of being synchronous, so that you have immediate response and feedback, the essential feature of most social media is it's asynchronous, that you put something out there and then there's a pause and a delay, which could be seconds, minutes, hours, days, and then the response comes back and then you think about that and then you send a response and so on.
Hmm.
Hyde makes the point that our evolutionary history has not equipped us to communicate in this way. This is a very bizarre, this asynchronous, disembodied way of communication. Is a very novel and unusual way of communication, and he argues, and it makes sense really, that this is one of the features that causes relational breakdown and also relational anxiety.
Mm.
You know, because you put a post out there, maybe something quite disclosing, so, you know, something about the way that you're feeling or something that's really important to you. You stick it out there on social media and then there's silence.
Hmm.
And then immediately you're thinking of, you know, do they like me, or are they trying to get at me, or, you know, is my friend, what are they doing? You know, so I don't get the immediate feedback that you would have if you're talking face to face, and that actually breeds a kind of anxiety about relationships.
Yeah, and it creates relationships which are brittle and fragile, and almost disposable, or more likely to be short-lived, because unlike real-world relationships, which take time to build, but once you've built them, they're kind of thick and grounded, and it is a big deal to kind of end a friendship, you know, or change your friendship group. But when it's all mediated through digital technologies, you can just block someone and mute them. You know, sometimes you can do it and not, you know, invisibly, so they don't know that you aren't reading their messages. You know, you can ghost them online. You can drop in and out of different kind of parasocial subgroups and niches online at the drop of a hat, a click of a button, and that means that all these relationships, you know. You might say, you know, I do more socializing than my parents did. You know, they would just go and hang out with their three best friends, whereas I'm talking to 100 people every evening, but sitting in my bedroom on my phone. But actually, the quality of the relationships is completely different.
Have you ever wrestled with tough questions about faith? Or maybe you've got a friend who's skeptical about Christianity. That's exactly why we want to send you a powerful resource that I believe needs to be in the hand of every believer. Justin Briley's book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. In this book, Justin reflects on 10 years of conversations with atheists, skeptics and believers alike, and explains why he still finds Christianity the most compelling explanation for life, the universe and everything in between. I know this book will strengthen your faith and equip you for meaningful conversations. And for a limited time, this book is our special thank you to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support ensures that content like this and other shows and programmes are available to bring faith-filled conversations to a world that needs them. So I encourage you to give today by going to premierinsight.org/give. That's premierinsight.org/give. Now on to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I'm fascinated by the way that the disembodiment leads to a much greater potential for evil. So, you know, if you can imagine two adolescents in a room, you know, and they're friends, and then somebody says something very catty or unpleasant or hurtful to the other person, you know, that there's evil there in the room, but it's basically it's localized within the room. It doesn't spread very far. I mean, one of them might go off and say, "Do you know what my friend said to me?" And it could pass it on a bit. But it's fundamentally the embodiment limits the spread of evil. Whereas once you're on social media, it's the very disembodiment which allows evil to spread at the most astonishing speed and with unforeseen consequences.
Mm. And theologians have often remarked on this, you know, looking at, you know, for example, the Genesis 1-2-3 narrative, in that part of the reason why God expelled Adam and Eve from the garden once they'd eaten from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was almost to protect them. Because if they continued to, you know, if they continued to dwell in this kind of eternal paradise, the finitude of our of us being limited creatures is actually good for us. It, as you say, it limits the evil we can do, it limits the harm we can do to ourselves and others. God didn't want us, once we had kind of opened up that Pandora's box, to mangle my folklore and mythology, he didn't want us to live forever and to be like the gods, to be like him. It was a protective impulse for us to be finite, limited creatures rather than infinite spiritual beings who could take this potential for sin and damage and harm and spread it infinitely.
That's right. One of the sad things, again, coming back to teenagers, that I've heard, and that is, you know, that some people have a real problem with bullying at school.
Mm.
But in the bad old days, you know, when you came home and shut the door, at last you were in a safe place. You know, the bullies couldn't get at you. But these days, there is no safe place.
No.
That bullying is going to carry on 24/7. And some of those tragic suicide cases is where, you know, when you look back, you see this horrific harassment and bullying which has been going on in cyberspace.
In some ways, I've heard some teachers say it's better at school because people are much less able to be on their phones because they're in class. And it's actually when you get home and everyone is back in their bedrooms that the wave of harassment and abuse and bullying via Snapchat or direct messages on Instagram or passing around memes on WhatsApp or whatever really reaches the crescendo is when all these parents of adolescents are completely, you know, leaving them unsupervised, where they're actually much more closely watched and controlled by teachers at school.
Yeah. Before we come on to the Christian aspects, there are just two other things I found really interesting from Haidt's book, and that is that he says that all children have two very highly developed strategies for building social relationships and for acculturation. And they're firstly a conformist bias, which is the safest strategy is to do what everyone else is doing. And then secondly, a prestige bias, looking for positive role models, looking for heroes. And he points out that social media unfortunately hacks these inbuilt biases in pretty toxic ways, so that social media platforms are the most effective conformity engines ever invented, squeezing everyone into a particular mold. But also, in social media platforms, prestige is based on the number of clicks and likes that you get, and therefore it's very often influencers rather than positive role models. It's other teenage influencers who become the prestige focus.
Mm. Is that new, though? I mean, if you went back generation and you asked children who their role models were, they wouldn't say their friends. They would say pop stars or footballers or someone else famous. Now it's internet influencers and YouTubers, but is that actually a different from looking up to idolizing another distant celebrity who's never heard of you?
Well, I think the argument is that in previous generations, that why were they a hero? There was some kind of excellence, you know. Yeah, oh, it was a pop star, but they were the best.
Good
pop
at singing,
star. Yeah, or they were
great at playing football.
Playing football, there was something they were outstanding at. But the argument is that the teenage influencer has no excellence. Apart from the fact that they're able to garner clicks from their colleagues, you know, from other adolescents, and therefore the positive effects of role models are completely lost.
Mm. And unlike a distant celebrity, an influencer is just as ignorant of your existence, but they cultivate very, very carefully the myth that they're your best friend. And you were, you know, they take you into their confidence or appear to be and into their very home in their videos. And it's, you know, people develop these very, very strong parasocial relationships where, you know, you feel like the influencer that you idolize is actually your best friend. And the influencer's content pursues that delusion. Whereas, you know, when you idolized a pop star, you got nothing back from that pop star. The pop star didn't make any effort in the stuff they were pumping out to pretend that they knew you and cared about you in your life. And so it's much less likely to become kind of sucked into these kind of destructive patterns.
That's right. But more the influencer is promoting body dysmorphia, you know, and plastic surgery and other factors which you might feel are distinctly unhealthy, and yet they have this extraordinary hold through the technology.
Yeah. Okay, so this is all pretty bleak stuff. You know, adolescents are getting bombarded by this kind of completely novel explosion of mental health disorders caused by an unintentional kind of cascade of new forms of communication technology. One, is there anything we can do about it? And two, is there anything distinctive that Christians in the church have to say about this issue, or are we just kind of throwing our hands up like everyone else is?
Well, perhaps if we take the Christian things first, I think firstly it's interesting how this whole issue of embodiment comes out again. And if there's anything that we as Christians ought to be able to encourage and support and have a strong philosophical, theological, biblical basis for, it's embodiment. You know, it's the importance of flesh and blood. We see that in the incarnation. We see it in creation itself. We see it in the nature of Christian community. We see it in the Holy Communion. Embodiment is an essential part of following Christ, worshiping Him with our bodies, and therefore this focus on the real world as opposed to the digital world, that is surely something that we as Christians can get behind and should be leading the way on.
And I suppose uniquely we worship a God who is incarnate in flesh, who didn't stay a distant spiritual deity, but came to, you know, understood that we could not reach God except by God coming down to earth and being born as a man and living like we did with us. And that tells us something about, as you say, about the importance of physical relationality as opposed to simply just knowing something intellectually.
And so it does seem so important, therefore, that our local church communities are emphasizing that, emphasizing the importance of face-to-face involvement, of sharing meals together, of sharing worship together physically, and maybe of being a safe space from all the digital technology which is constantly invading.
I mean, are you literally suggesting that we should actually lean into that more and try and kind of return churches to an analog era? You know, hand your phone in at the door. The you know, we're not going to be showing any YouTube videos on the big screen during the sermon. This is going to be a kind of a strip back and kind of almost take some of the tech saturated world, leave that at the door of the sanctuary and make our Sunday worship deliberately kind of lo-fi.
I think there's definitely an argument for that. It seems paradoxical in a way, but I suspect there's going to be increasing hunger for that kind of lo-fi analog way of living, and maybe if the local Christian community can exemplify that, people will hunger for it. It's difficult, isn't it? Because there are obvious value in having digital technology. You know, I like the fact that I can have lots of different Bible translations on my on my iPad, and the original languages and commentaries and all that kind of stuff. And to go back to an analog Bible is a loss, but also maybe there is something important there that as a kind of sign.
And I wonder if maybe more practically for kind of Sunday school children's groups and even like non-Sunday stuff, you know, a lot of church youth groups have other meetings, you know, on Friday evenings or in the week and things like that. Maybe those are spaces where churches can model a like deeply embodied and relational way to be together as young people, you know. So put away the phones, turn off the Xbox, you know, we've got an hour and a half as a group of teenagers with a youth worker. We're going to, what can we do that's not just, you know, we're going to do some play, we're going to hang out, but like actually how can we try and replace some of the building blocks that they might not be getting in the rest of their week, because the rest of their play time as children, the rest of their socializing is entirely mediated by the internet.
Interesting, isn't it? Just brainstorming. I'm thinking about how, therefore, making music together is synchronous.
Mm-hmm.
Things like physical sports.
Can't play football. I mean, you can play football online, but it's not the same as running around and kicking an actual football.
Thinking about drama, about, you know, creating, doing, acting out things together. All of these are examples. Eating, sharing a meal together.
Yeah.
All of these are examples of a synchronous, embodied activity, which is so essential and so important and part of our Christian witness.
And there's a paradox, I think, in that, you know, when I talk to people who do work with young people and do youth groups and things in the church, they say that, you know, when you try and put on these events, people are very resistant and hostile because, you know, teenagers and Gen Zers are, you know, they feel quite anxious about real world meetups and they feel quite overwhelmed by the prospect of, you know, being dumped in a room without their phones. But actually, I wonder, or I hope, I suspect that deep down there probably is a hunger for that. You know, we are fundamentally, you know, this has only happened since 2010. And, you know, human beings have been around for hundreds of thousands of years. Like, we are hardwired in our biology to be relational social beings. That's slightly being hijacked, maybe, if we take Haidt's thesis to be correct. But deep down, people still thrive and flourish when they, you know, play sport together, cook food together, do art together, spend time together in person. And so I wonder, actually, there's a paradox there where, you know, church youth groups might worry if we try and lean into this kind of lo-fi analog way of being together, people will stop coming and we'll turn them off. But actually, if you push past that initial resistance or anxiety, maybe there's a deep yearning and a hunger because they're not getting this anywhere else.
Yeah. And the second thing I would say, and that is, I'm increasingly impressed about the concept that there's a spiritual warfare going on in the digital world. You know, why is it that something that seems so relatively harmless, just connecting a whole lot of children and adolescents together, on a platform and using a bit of sophisticated technology, why is it that these terribly evil things start pouring out, that there is different forms of damage and evil? And I think a spiritual perspective on that is something we've talked about previously, about the biblical idea of the powers and the principalities, that there are spiritual forces of evil. These are properties which are mysterious and inexplicable, but which seem to exacerbate human weaknesses and human foibles and human evil. And there is a spiritual element, therefore, behind, in my view, behind some of the evil consequences of digital technology.
And like we talked about in that recent episode, there's this idea that evil is fundamentally deceitful and it's parasitical on human creativity and the things that we make, and it manipulates and twists and exploits them towards kind of unintended evil purposes. And I know, I think that explains a lot of what happens in social media. You know, the people who made TikTok did not set out to create this kind of depression machine that's destroying teenage girls' lives. They simply set out to try and build an app that would recommend really funny, interesting videos. And they accidentally made an algorithm that is, you know, supernova in its ability to suggest the video that you want to watch next. And that just gets better and better and better. And now you find, you know, teenagers report spending 10 hours a day mindlessly watching these videos, getting cut off from real life and seeing their mental health go through the toilet as a result. No one at TikTok intended this. They just wanted to make a bit of money and create an app that teenagers would like to use. And yet somehow the kind of creativity of a few coders in China has ended up, you know, causing this, as you say, staggering amount of real world harm.
Yeah, and therefore, you know, this is a spiritual issue. This is something which we need to pray about. The church needs to inform others, parents, tech workers, of these issues. It's not a sort of just simplistic anti-tech stance, but it's just an awareness of the reality of evil. And the need to combat it, to resist evil, to pray against it.
And what encourages me is that, you know, Height's not a Christian. That in fact, it's not the church at all that is at the forefront of doing this research and talking about some of the harms on young brains of social media and smartphones. It's coming from wider society and it's, you know, it's chiming with people. It's making ripples. You know, when Height's book was published, it was all over the place. And I keep reading news stories about, you know, schools which are implementing smartphone bans. Or there was one town in Hertfordshire where parents have started circulating a pledge where you kind of sign up publicly to not give your child a smartphone until they turn 14 in an effort to kind of, you know, solve the problem of, well, if all my friends have a smartphone but I don't, it's very, very difficult to resist. You know, this is a collective action problem. Let's have a collective solution and use some of those biases that Height talks about, you know, conformism and prestige, and use them against smartphones. So conform to what everyone else is doing. But if no one else has a smartphone and no one else is on TikTok and Snapchat, then you don't need to be either. And shift the prestige towards people who are real world, actually admirable role models who have high status in your community, not because they're internet influencers or because they're the best at posting, but because they're actually good at something in the real world. And so there is certainly, like, efforts are underway, and the church's job is really, I guess, to find out how it can turbocharge and support parents and young people in creating structures that prevent them from getting sucked into some of the destructive patterns that we've seen.
Yeah, so Height has four main recommendations, and they are: one, no smartphones before age 14, or some other people say 16. And he says, you know, if you need to stay in touch, use a simple
dumb phone
for communication. Two, no social media before 16. It's interesting, isn't it, that 16 across the world is, you know, you're not allowed to vote, you're not allowed to go to in armed forces, you're not allowed to drink alcohol, you can't give consent for sexual intercourse. 16 is regarded as the kind of age of adults, the origins of adulthood, the cusp of adulthood. And therefore, I think in the same way, social media needs to be seen as this thing that can only be used by adults. It's too toxic, yeah, too dangerous, too...
It's like smoking, to go back to the beginning. Yeah, it's like smoking. It's obvious to us that we wouldn't let children get tattoos and smoke cigarettes before they are at least 16 or 18. And as you say, it wasn't obvious to us at all that scrolling on Instagram or Snapchat or TikTok was as dangerous. But as we learned that, increasingly, we need to take steps. I guess the question is, can the genie be put back in the bottle? you know, I saw Australia a few months ago is talking about passing a law that would ban social media before 16. But age verification on the internet is notoriously difficult to do and riddled with loopholes and raises other kind of privacy concerns. So it is an open question. I think we are still unknown whether it is possible to backtrack.
Absolutely.
And meaningfully rebuild the social internet to exclude children.
Well, and just like the tobacco industry, you can absolutely guarantee, I'm afraid, that the big tech companies are going to be absolutely opposed. They're going to use all their lobbying muscle. They're going to use, you know, science arguments to do everything to oppose this.
Mm. And you know, you pointed out Jonathan Haidt's more recently written an essay using some material from lawsuits against TikTok, which reveal that internal research in TikTok has known for years about how destructive it is. They're very, very aware that it is ruining their users' lives, and yet the profit motive is strong, and they have suppressed that information, just like the tobacco industry, which knew about the harm it was causing to their users' lungs for many years, but they didn't want to stop selling cigarettes, and TikTok doesn't want to stop people making money off TikTok, and so they're going to suppress that information and fight with all their power and all their lobbying muscle any efforts to regulate them.
Yeah, so the other two recommendations are: three, make schools completely phone free. And there
Which
is
increasingly already on that way, isn't it? You know, many schools already have de facto phone bans.
It is, although you pointed out that you've been looking at primary schools in the local area.
Yeah, and several of them have kind of, you know, when you do the little tour, the head teacher has kind of mentioned their phone policy, which is always, you know, we don't allow children to have phones in the classroom and this kind of stuff. They have to hand them in if they have a phone. But I'm slightly horrified at the fact that a primary school, you know, this goes up to age 11 max, a primary school has to have a smartphone policy because enough of their parents are sending their, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old children in with a smartphone, which just blows my brain. But yes, it is a thing. I think schools have, you know, from a kind of behavior and discipline point of view, have long since realized that it's a recipe for disaster to let children have smartphones. And so almost everyone I know who works in schools as teachers say that, yeah, there's well-established rules about you're allowed to have a phone. But if it comes out of your bag or out of your locker, it's confiscated. And they're pretty strict on that kind of stuff now.
Although I've heard that it's very common for children to have one in their pocket, and the notifications, they're often getting 60, 100 notifications an hour. And, you know, surreptitiously checking.
In the playground, maybe, yeah. Difficult, yeah.
And then the final recommendation is increase unsupervised physical play in the real world. And that's the one which I suspect is going to be one of the hardest. Because there seems to be so many forces going in the opposite direction. And yet the evidence is growing that this is a really important part of childhood.
Mm. And unlike smartphones, this is not a recent phenomenon. You know, this is a long cultural sea change dating back, you know, probably approaching 60, 70 years now of parents becoming more protective of children and being less willing to contemplate physical risk. And so turning that one around feels like a much bigger piece of work, ironically, than, you know, stopping kids from having smartphones in the classroom or finding a way to block under 16s from being on Instagram.
Well, so it's parental anxiety, which is as much the problem as adolescent anxiety, isn't it? It is whatever is feeding these irrational, overwhelming fears of parents is something that needs to be addressed, because unintentionally they're damaging their children.
And I guess from a Christian perspective, again, there is plenty of theological resources around fear and trust that we can turn to in scripture and in Christian writings. You know, God has got a lot of things to say about fear, what we should and what we should not fear, and in what we place our trust and what we don't. And I think that, again, is an area maybe where churches have a bit of a job to do, to be, are our churches teaching on what is an appropriate fear to express, where we should be directing our fears? But if we have unhealthy exaggerated fears about harms for our children, which, you know, a lot of people would say, well, it's a good thing to be worried about your kids, but actually, is it? Is that the way of life in its fullness that we're called to? Do our children belong to us as a possession that we have to jealously guard, or can we entrust them to God? You know, there's a lot of stuff, there's a lot of conversation, I think, on that particular one that churches can get involved in.
And yet, you know, I was just thinking safeguarding concerns, you know, that this is, are you really going to say you're going to reduce the amount of supervision on the little darlings? And that you're going it's to say difficult. That this is, you know, it seems to run completely against the grain.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And that's a quite a nuanced bit of work, isn't it? About how do we continually ramp up our efforts to protect children and vulnerable young people from real physical, emotional, spiritual, sexual abuse, while potentially opening them up to more low level risk in their play and in their socialization and in their development. I mean, goodness me, good luck to whoever's going to try and thread that needle.
Yes, quite. Yeah, well, interesting stuff.
Interesting stuff. Yeah, we'd love to know your thoughts, particularly those who are parents or those who are themselves teenagers. I'm sure we have some, I hope we have some adolescent listeners to MoLad. So yeah, let us know your thoughts on anything we've discussed today. Do you know what impact do you see social media having on your own children? What are some of the things you might have tried to counteract that, if you think it is negative? Is this all overblown? You know, there is a strong strain of people who basically reject Hype's thesis and think this is a moral panic, who question some of the data he's marshalling and the correlations he's drawing. So I'm aware there's lots of very thoughtful, intelligent, compassionate people who aren't tearing their hair out at this. So love to know your own thoughts. Get in touch with us by emailing MoLad, MOLAD, at premier.org.uk. And we're also always interested, of course, in suggestions and ideas for things that we could talk about in future episodes. There's lots more of resources on Dad's website, John Wyatt, WYATT.com. Lots of videos to watch and articles to read. And you can also find out some of my own journalism at tswyatt.com. And I just wanted to flag up as well, we did an episode some of you might have heard about 6 months ago or so in the summer last year with the brilliant American writer Andy Crouch, who has written a couple of books about technology in the home in particular. And that episode kind of talked in detail about Christian families and some good practices and things we can do, but also drew on some of Jonathan Haidt's research. So if you're interested in this conversation, I would recommend scrolling up the feed to find our conversation with Andy Crouch. And I'll try and remember to put a link into the podcast notes as well. But otherwise, thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.